105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, I'm really happy to say that you're going to hear an interview with Daniel James Brown, whose award-winning and New York Times best-selling book, The Boys in the Boat, has been adapted for young readers. Daniel James Brown grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area and attended Diablo Valley College, the University of California at Berkeley, and UCLA. He taught writing at San Jose State University and Stanford before becoming a technical writer and editor. He now writes narrative nonfiction books full-time. His primary interest as a writer in bringing compelling historical events to life as vividly and accurately as he can. Daniel James Brown lives in the country outside of Seattle, Washington, with his wife, two daughters, and an assortment of cats, dogs, chickens, and honeybees. When not writing, he is likely to be birding, gardening, fly fishing, reading American history, or chasing bears away from the beehives. When I spoke with Daniel James Brown, I asked him to begin by talking about the decision to adapt The Boys in the Boat for young readers.
When the adult version of The Boys in the Boat first came out, most of the people coming to the book talks were older, and I didn't notice a lot of young people. I don't think there were a lot of young people there. But within a few months, I started seeing more and more young people show up at these talks, and they started telling me their stories about why they enjoyed the book. Mm-hmm. And so it just sort of gradually became clear that there was an interest there among younger readers and also among their parents. I mean, I get a lot of email every day about this book, and one of the things I hear over and over from older readers is something to the effect of, I wish my children or my grandchildren could read this story for themselves.
Yeah.
So it became clear that that would be a good thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. When young readers have come up to you about the original book, I suspect this book hasn't been seen by too many young readers yet.
Right.
What have their reactions varied at all from adult reactions? Have you noticed any patterns in what they pick up on?
Yeah, I mean, for older readers, it tends to the book is often particularly for much older readers. Some of the reaction is just nostalgic.
Mm-hmm.
They enjoy the fact that the book took them back to when they were young. The younger people who come up to me at book talks and want their book signed, they're mostly kids who are on a team or in some kind of a group, like a band or whatever, something where they're striving to reach some kind of a personal goal.
Mm-hmm.
And they're interested in it from that vantage point, not as much as sort of looking back as a, wow, this is the kind of way I'd like to approach my life. And so that's really, it's really cool to see all these fresh-faced young people, interested in it for that kind of reason.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, in reading the new book, and I have read both of them, I noticed you have at the beginning a who's who, which is sort of a graphic listing,
mm-hmm.
With pictures of the main characters in this true story. And then at the end you have a timeline, and you also have a little side article called The Art of Rowing as Taught by Al Ulbrichtson, and it talks about some of the things that he stressed as very important when the team was rowing. I wondered, was it fun for you to come up with these things for young readers, and also if you can talk a little bit about what else you had to do to adjust the book?
Yeah, young people tend to... For one thing, they can be very visually oriented, so we put more photographs in the book in the young readers edition than in the adult edition. And we also added things like that timeline and a list of characters and ways that kids could easily visualize who the characters are and what a rowing shell looks like and how it performs and those kinds of things. Because we didn't want to put a lot of heavy text in. One of the things you always want to do when you're writing for younger readers is to keep the essence of the book, to keep the spirit of the book, to keep the whatever the book teaches you about history and life, but to do it in a way that is a little more digestible. And so those kinds of that front back matter and back matter are the kind of things that help kids get a glance at something and begin to absorb it without having to wade through a lot of heavy text.
That,
you know, adult readers might find it fine to read several pages about a rowing technique, but kids are, you're going to lose kids if you do that.
Right. I noticed that the cover is very different. I love both of these covers. But this one, you can see the faces on the members of the team a little bit. You know, they're not right up close, but it makes it feel a little bit more immediate. And I wondered if that was specifically because of the age of the readers, or if you know what the cover artist was thinking in this case.
Yeah, and I to tell you the truth, I don't. You know, covers traditionally belong to the publisher.
Yeah.
They were very, Viking kids were very, very cooperative with me, and we went back and forth about the cover, and I had a great deal of input into it. Ultimately, they make the decisions because it's pretty much a marketing thing. But
it is, yeah.
I didn't think about it in those terms, but I do think that one of the things we wanted to do was make it more personal, and so again, showing faces is a way to do that. So
yeah.
It's the right thing about that is that.
Do you mind if I just read a paragraph from this
sure.
book? So this is early on. It's right after the coach has told the boys who's going to be on the team, and they go out for, I think, their first sort of rowing experience together as a team. And let's see. At the north end of the lake, the coxswain called out, "Way, 'nuff." The boys stopped rowing. The shell glided to a stop, the long oars trailing in the water alongside them. The boys sat without talking, breathing heavily, exhaling plumes of white breath in the darkness. Even now that they had stopped rowing, their breathing was synchronized, and for a brief, fragile moment, it seemed to Joe as if all of them were part of a single thing, something alive with breath and spirit of its own. First of all, I just loved that. It was so beautiful. But it just felt to me so much like it embodied a point that you were making about what this whole experience was for this team. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, I mean, on a very fundamental level, this book is about a bunch of young people who come together and learn to pull together and learn to become part of something larger than themselves. And that scene is one of those places where you first begin to feel that in the book, where Joe, the sort of principal character that I center the book on, I remember he was the one that talked to me about that first row together. It was extremely emotional moment for him to begin to feel part of something bigger than himself, to feel that he'd fit in someplace because he had had a very difficult childhood and didn't feel as if he fit in any place. And so, and it wasn't just for Joe. That's the nature of rowing. The beautiful thing about it is that it's such a cooperative sport. It's a sport that depends so much on each member of the crew trusting the other members of the crew at all times. It's almost a spiritual experience for a lot of people who do it. In fact, I do hear people talk about it in spiritual terms all the time. But it's certainly a very emotionally intense experience. And so that was the first time when Joe began to understand that about this new thing, you know, that he was beginning to do.
Right. And that's Joe Rantz. And when you first met him, he was a much older man, and he was ill, and he's the person who shared this story with you originally. I enjoyed the way that he would refer to the boat. He always talked about the boat, and it came to have a certain meaning beyond just the boat itself. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, that was a revelation to me the first day I met Joe. When I met Joe, he was in the last few weeks of his last couple months of his life.
Right.
Yeah. He was living under hospice care at his daughter's house, and his daughter invited me down there to talk to him. And the first time I sat down with Joe and began to tell me about this experience, there were tears in his eyes whenever he began to talk about what he called the boat.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I didn't understand at first. I thought by the boat he meant this beautiful wooden shell that they had rowed in, but I quickly came to understand that by the boat he meant not the boat itself and of course, and then the boys he had rowed with, but really something more than that, this sort of almost intangible thing that they had all become together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 75 years before at that point in Berlin that summer, this this almost perfect, beautiful thing that a crew can be when it's really going well for them, and so that was the way he always talked about it, as the boat. And yeah, I made a mistake that first day. I was so impressed by that story that I said, Joe, can I write a book about your life? And he immediately shook his head and looked down the floor and said, no, I don't want you to write about me. But then he looked up and he said, but you could write a book about the boat if you want. And it was just, it just blew me away. Because I understood, you know, at that moment what he wanted me to try to do, and what I really did try to do in the book was capture the essence of that that togetherness, that experience. And so, yeah, that's what I set out to do.
Yeah, wonderful. You already mentioned that Joe had a really hard childhood, and so did some of the others on the boat, maybe many of them. And this led, in Joe's case and in the case of some of the other boys, it led to a desire for family and stability. And I felt like this had a huge effect on their success in the boat. And I wonder if you might talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it, stability. You know, they were living through the Depression. They were living in times when things were so very uncertain. Many of them had come from very difficult circumstances. And to some extent or another, they were all driven, I think, by this desire to find something they could hold on to find a sort of a place they could call home,
mm-hmm.
Which became the crew and the crew house, become part of a family, which the crew became to them to some extent. And I think it was partly a product of the times. As I say, life was hard, and nothing was certain in those days for these young men. And rowing together gave them that. I really like that word, stability, they used. It gave mm-hmm. them solidity of a place to ground their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was part of what motivated them to go through the quite arduous process of becoming good at this sport. And it was also a sort of reward of having done that.
You mentioned the Depression. You know, I felt like a huge part of the story was how people pulled together in hard times, times of economic strife. There's the threat of war very soon. The war comes after the Olympics. Do you have any thoughts as the author of this book on how that compares to today when times are tough? And do you think people are still pulling together in the same way, or do you think it's changed a lot?
Yeah, you know, I often talk about this in my book talks. I think in the largest sense, when I stand back from this book, I see it as a kind of a metaphor. These young people that climbed in a boat and learned to pull together so powerfully and so beautifully, I see it as a metaphor for what that whole generation did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had to get in the same boat. The Depression put them in the same boat.
Yeah.
And on the whole, they did. They learned to pull together and get great things done. They built great monuments like the Grand Coulee Dam. They won World War II on two fronts. They built the most prosperous era in the country's history after the war. They learned to pull together and build great teams. And yeah, I'm not sure that that's as true today as it was in the 1930s. And I think that's part of why the book has resonated so well with people, is I think people like to think that we're capable of that again.
Yeah.
And so it's really, you know, it really is all about pulling together. And I do think that that maybe is also one reason why a lot of older people are so anxious to have their kids read this book. Partly it's just so that they can understand the history, and partly so that they can understand the time when, boy, you just didn't get, you know, we weren't worried about whether you had the best pair of shoes that money could buy. You worried about whether you had any shoes. And part of it, though, was I think that older people are remembering a time when we were pulling together better, and they want their kids or their grandkids to have a sense of that.
Yeah. It occurs to me, just speaking with you now, yesterday I heard a story on public radio about the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, and they were talking about stories of people in the stadium pulling together and helping each other when there was no water, no food, no services. It was horrible. And that makes me think, too, of 9/11 and the way New Yorkers, you know, sort of transformed from their stereotypes to people who were helping each other. And I wonder if there's a certain universality of experience that existed in the 30s that has changed, and so maybe our society as a whole doesn't feel the tough times so much as in individual, smaller moments. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, no, I think it does. I do. I think we're so much more fractured these days, and there's so much more emphasis on individual achievement, which is great. I'm a huge fan of individual achievement, but I do think we've lost some of that sense of fabric. And yeah, I remember after 9/11, you know, I mean, it, as horrible as 9/11 was, it was refreshing to see the country come together for at least a while. And I do think that there's something lost there. And again, as I say, I think that's part of why people have responded so well to the book.
Yeah. One of the things that was hard for Joe in his life is that he was abandoned by his family, and he found himself unexpectedly on his own and independent. And it was interesting, as I read the book, it struck me that this situation coincides with a very popular YA fantasy. You know, abandonment is a common theme in everything from Hansel and Gretel to Harry Potter. And I just was thinking, you know, this story may resonate for young readers on that level, you know, just like the desire to be independent and make something of yourself without your parents getting in your way.
You know? Yeah, no. No, I think it will. I mean, you know, when I sat down and write the book, it wasn't written for young people in particular, but I do think, you know, that Joe was, as you say, abandoned as basically a child, and had, that's a very traumatic experience, and he had to reshape his life in very fundamental ways in order to first survive and then become what he wanted to become. And I think all young people most certainly aren't abandoned, but all young people go through a phase where they feel as if they're on their own, that their parents don't understand them, and that, and that they have to come to terms with the world in their own way and figure out what that way is. And yeah, so it happens that Joe's experience, although extreme, is probably pretty universal. And we shall see, you know, as this Young Readers edition comes out, see whether kids react to it that way and see themselves reflected in that. But I think you're right. I think they're very likely to. It's a pretty universal experience.
Yeah, absolutely.
The feeling of alienation.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, I put it in terms of this fantasy of being on your own, but in fact, it's true that they all go through a period of separation and being at least emotionally on their own.
But it is, as you say, also a fantasy. I mean, young people want to do that.
Yeah.
And they're compelled by nature to do that.
Right.
So, yeah, I think fantasy is also a good way of looking at it.
And another theme in this book that I think will resonate for your new or expanded young audience, and you kind of mentioned this before, is sports are still likely to be in their lives and futures much more so than they are maybe typically for your adult readers. You know, I mean, kids are on teams and they are in gym class and da-da. Did this affect the way that you approached the revision of or the recasting of this book?
Well, I don't think we had to do much recasting in terms of that because it is a story about a team on one level. I suppose on one level it's a sports book, although I think ultimately it's very much more than a sports book. But it is about, you know, it is about coaches and teammates and the rigors of competition and becoming physically adept at whatever it is you're trying to do. And so that's already all there in the story. And I think that that's certainly one of the things we wanted to retain as we went through the process of, you know, reshaping the book. And we removed quite a bit of material, but that was certainly one of the things we didn't want to remove because, as you say, it is so much a part of what is meaningful to a lot of young people in terms of their day-to-day lives is how they fit in. You know, not just how they fit in on a team, but how they fit in generally with their peers, which was, again, something Joe had to do, and the team was just one aspect of that. So I think that was there, and we, in reshaping the book, it's one of the things we deliberately tried to, I wanted to make sure that still came through loud and clear.
Now, I mentioned earlier Al Ulbrichtsen, who was the coach, not the freshman coach, which is where the team starts out, but the main coach. And he had this dream of bringing home gold from the 36 Olympics very early on. And you have this list early in the book. You have a list of the clear series of imposing hurdles that they would have to clear. Let's see. He'd have to outsmart Cal coach Kai Albright. I'm just going to highlight this. He needed to find a crew that could beat Albright's best. That crew would have to outrace the top boats from the east at the Olympic trials. They'd face the best oarsmen in the world. They would have to beat the British, the Italians, the Germans. So that list of hurdles struck me as a wonderful way early in the book that you were building suspense. And apart from whether or not this is a book for young adults, I wondered if you could talk a little bit about writing nonfiction, creative nonfiction, or journalistic nonfiction, as you however you would refer to this, and talk about building suspense in that kind of a book.
Yeah, the term I usually use is narrative nonfiction, but
narrative nonfiction.
Yeah, it's all the same thing. Nonfiction like this, narrative nonfiction, is it has the same burden that any other kind of good writing does, which is there needs to be an arc to it. There needs to be an arc to the story. The reader needs to be pulled forward. And so you have the same challenge as a fiction writer to make sure that there is suspense. And it was particularly a challenge in this book because the way we structured the book, it was pretty clear to the reader from the very beginning that ultimately the boys prevail in this endeavor that they have, and that they win the gold medal at the end. And so I had the added burden of, okay, if you know how it ends, why are you going to read it?
Right.
And I discovered that, you know, along the way, that's what's interesting about the book is about the story, is about how they overcame those hurdles. That, yeah, we know how it ends, but they didn't know how it ends. They had this formidable series of things they had to overcome. And so, as a writer, what you do is you try to put your reader in their shoes and see the world through their eyes. And as they come up to each one of their hurdles, create the sense that they had, which is that they don't know if they're going to make it past that next hurdle. So it's really a matter, you know, of small things like beginning chapters or ending chapters with something unresolved that re- reader wants to see resolved, and so goes into the next chapter, and but pretty much the same things that a fiction writer would use to build that sense of anticipation and suspense.
Mm-hmm. Did that happen organically as you wrote, or did you find that you at the end of a draft would go back and try to interject some of the suspense that you wanted to lead them to the next section you'd already written, for example?
Yeah, you know, for me that happened pretty organically. Mm-hmm. I mean, the way I went about writing this book is I spent the better part of a year just getting a hold of the story, just doing a lot of research and understanding the big broad brush strokes of the book, the arc of the book, before I ever wrote a word.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went back and I just started writing scene by scene by scene, because I knew at that point what the arc was going to be. And for me, as a writer, the way I work is I don't actually sit down and write a scene. I think of every chunk in the book as a scene. I don't write a scene until I have thought about it and researched it and found every little detail about it that might be important and worked it over in my mind and visualized it. And I get to the point where I'm kind of a fear-driven writer. I get to the point where I'm afraid I'm going to lose it if I don't write it down. Then I go sit and write it down. But I make a point of not sitting down and writing a scene until I get this feeling that, okay, you got to get it on paper or you're going to lose it.
Yeah.
And so that's just sort of the way that I proceed. And so at that point it comes together organically for me pretty well. I think I have an intuitive sense of where that scene needs to end so that the next scene will be set up well and the reader will be pulled forward.
Okay. All right, great. Let's see. Well, you just mentioned research. I know that some of your research was through interviews with Joe, for example, although you only had a couple of months with him. I wonder, did you use the internet a lot, or do you find you're still very much going to the library and using old-fashioned books when you do your research?
Well, both, really. I mean, I spent a lot of time. For instance, there's a fair amount in the book about what was happening in Germany in the 1930s, mm-hmm. and so a lot of that was just old-fashioned book research, going to the library, getting lots and lots of books and finding relevant material in them. And a lot of the research was on studying old newspapers from the 1930s on microfilm, and a lot of it was sitting down with the relatives of the descendants of these nine young men.
Mm-hmm.
And I should say these families were enormously helpful. They brought letters and diaries and photographs and all kinds of material to me, and they spent hundreds of hours probably all together talking to me about it.
Mm-hmm.
So all of that. But then on top of that, I do find the internet very useful in all kinds of ways. One of the things is I like when I write one of these scenes, I like to have very fine grained detail in. So I like to know, I might want to know, for instance, what time the sun came up that morning or what the weather was like exactly in Seattle on that day in 1935. And you can find all that on the internet now. The National Observatory has a website where you can find out what time the sun came up and what time it went down, what phase the moon was, and so on and so forth. On any day in history, you can get online and find weather records for a particular date in Seattle. And so you get this very, very specific data or information that then helps you write a scene with very granular, specific kinds of details that I'm not sure it would be possible to write without the enormous resource that the internet has become. So
yeah.
I find it a very, very, very useful thing.
Okay, great. May I read you one more little piece that I had a question about?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is toward the end of the book. It's the beginning of the chapter, Fighting, Fuming, and Coming Together.
As Joe drifted into sleep aboard the Manhattan that night, the first light of dawn crept over Berlin, where Nazi police and soldiers were marching groups of men, women, and children through the streets at gunpoint. The arrests had begun hours earlier, under the veil of night. The Nazis were moving gypsy families living in shanties and wagons out of a Berlin suburb and into detention camps. In time, they would be sent east to death camps and murdered. Their removal was just one more step in a process that had been unfolding for months. The Nazis were transforming Berlin into something like a vast movie set, an artificial world with all horror and anti-Semitism hidden away. Such a powerful and horrible moment. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the deception behind the 36 Olympics.
Yeah, you know, it was something of a revelation to me. I mean, I had known that the Nazis used the 1936 Berlin Olympics as a propaganda tool, but I really hadn't realized the depths of the cynicism with which they went about that task until I did a lot of research about the subject, and I was just blown away, taken aback by how systematic they were and how complete their deception was as they began to stage the Berlin Olympics. Mm. They really did. I mean, they literally scrubbed the streets of Berlin in some places to try to make Berlin look as clean and modern, efficient and progressive and desirable a place as possible. And that's really the Berlin and the Germany that hundreds of thousands of Americans saw when they went to Berlin that summer. You know, most Americans, in fact, most Americans, including most of the Olympic athletes, came back from Berlin late that summer, believing that Germany was a very desirable place. It was a very nice place to live, and they were favorably impressed by it because they were unable to see what was just starting to happen at that point out of sight. Outside of Berlin and across the whole country, really. And so, you know, they succeeded in that propaganda effort. And as I say, I was staggered by it.
Yeah.
Became kind of obsessed by it. I actually wrote much more about it than wound up in the book. I tend to do that as a writer. I often get obsessed and I write too much about something. So my editor wisely helped me cut it down to what was really most helpful.
It's interesting, you know, we talked earlier about a universality of experience, and what strikes me is that the internet would never let anything like this deception exist today. Someone would be taking pictures or videos and posting it on the internet, either legally or illegally, depending on the regime. And there may be a certain romanticism about the universality of experience during the Depression, but there's also this other side to our modern world, right?
That's interesting. I had never thought about that, but you're absolutely right. There's no way that, particularly this period where they were leading, this is all before the Holocaust, but things were beginning to happen that were unseen by most of the world, including a lot of people in Germany, and that could never have happened in today's world. As you say, there would have been cell phones, there would have been stuff on the internet instantly.
I don't want to forget to ask you an important question about this book, which is, can you talk about the sport of rowing and what about it is so punishing, which is it's a real theme in this book, that it is an extremely punishing, difficult sport to succeed at.
Yeah, I mean, I was taken aback again by just how brutally tough rowing is. I mean, it's kind of deceptive. It looks much easier than it is if you just sitting on the shore and watching the shell go
by. It looks so simple. They're just gliding.
Graceful, and you're pulling yours. What could be hard about this? It's just absolutely brutal. For one thing, you use every muscle in the body, which is one of the reasons it's such a popular fitness sport these days. Every muscle in your body, every bone in your body hurts at the end of a rigorous workout because you're using all of them. And to row at this level, particularly the Olympic level, the body has to consume and process oxygen at a rate that's just phenomenal. Lactic acid builds up in the muscles. It requires an extraordinary amount of fitness. Some rowing coach once said that putting eight men or women in a shell and asking them to row a 2,000-meter Olympic race is like asking them to play two NBA basketball games back-to-back and doing it all in about 6 minutes in terms of the physiological toll that it takes on the body.
Yeah.
So there's just, you know, I was just really amazed to see how hard it is physically and also mentally. It's also, because there's a lot of pain involved in it, it takes a lot of mental toughness to motivate yourself to go back down there at 5 in the morning on some cold, wintry day in Seattle and go out in that cold lake and row in the sleet and the snow or whatever. It really requires a certain amount of character, too. So I became a big fan, a big admirer of rowers as a bunch of people. They tend to have a lot of character and to have pretty good sense of themselves. And I mean, not in an egotistical way, actually just the opposite. Because they have to fit in with a crew, they tend to be really nice people, really easy to get along with.
Yeah.
So I've become a fan of them as a class of people.
Let's see. I wanted to know if you're working on any new projects yet, or if you're still, you know, so fully involved in this that you aren't yet.
Yeah, pretty much the latter. I mean, I'm actively seeking another topic, and I've got a few ideas that I'm trying to find time to explore. But I'm still so, my head is still full of this story. I mean, I enjoy talking about it. My mind is still in that world, and I don't know, maybe as a writer, maybe at some point you just have to shoot your old story and kill it and move on, but it's still living with me, and I'm not ready to let go of it, and so it's challenging, to say the least, to clear enough space in my head and enough time on my calendar to really get serious about the next book, but I am determined to do that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and just seeing the way people received this story, you know, I mean, it just is an amazing, amazing story, and the reception has been so powerful for people. It's I can see why it would be hard to let go of it.
Yeah. It's hard to let go of it, and it's also got sort of a high bar for the next story. You
That's
know?
True,
I mean,
yeah.
You naturally want to write something that is as compelling as the thing you just wrote. And so this, you know, I should say this story had all the elements of a good story before I ever touched it. I mean, it just was a good story. And as a writer, I just tried to do justice to it and try to capture it. And so, you know, when you go out, unlike fiction writer, I'm like a novelist, I can't just make something up. I have to go out and find a real story that's out there. And so that's a time-consuming process.
Right, and actually, I've got two more questions for you, and my last question actually has to do with this a little bit. But before I get to that one, I just wanted to ask you really quickly if you've read any books lately that you've particularly enjoyed or might recommend to listeners.
Yeah, I read a lot of the same genre that I write, or narrative nonfiction, creative nonfiction. I just recently read Hampton Slide's The Kingdom of Ice, which I thought was a really, really well-done book. It's about a polar expedition that goes bad, as polar expeditions tend to do,
yeah.
I guess. And they get in all kinds of trouble. But it's an amazing, it is an amazing story, and Hampton is an amazing writer, and I was very impressed by that book.
What's the time period of the expedition?
I think it was the early 1900s. I don't remember the year exact, but early.
Okay. Great. Any others that you'd point to?
You know, I'm also a huge fan of Laura Hillenbrand, and so when Unbroken came out, I dropped what I was doing and just sort of dissected that book, and I really admire Laura's work a great deal, too. But that book's been out for quite a while, of course.
Yeah, no, but it's a wonderful book. definitely. All right, so here's my last question that I mentioned a minute ago. So, and as you said, this book encompasses so much: history, friendship, sports, hard work, goals, pulling together. It works so well as an entire piece, and I think really gives readers a beautiful sense of what Joe found so hard to pin down when he was referring to the boat or thinking about the spirituality of his experience or all of the boys' experience. And my radio show is for writers as well as readers. So for the writers who are listening, I wondered if you might talk about, writers are often asked where they get their ideas, but I was wondering if we could recast that and if you could offer advice for writers about how to recognize the best ideas.
Right. Yeah, well, yeah, that's an interesting topic for me because that's what I'm doing right now. As I said, I've looked at dozens and dozens of potential topics for a next book, and something always seems to be missing, because it really does take a lot of separate elements to create a narrative that has all the suspense and drive that you want. So what do you look for? What I look for is I look for characters who are interesting and maybe a little out of the ordinary, or at the very least characters with whom I think my readers can identify on some level. I look at a setting, and by setting I mean both place and time. And for me it's very powerful for some reason. I really care about what the physical setting is. And so it needs to be a place and a time that is rich and interesting enough personally to me that I want to spend a lot of time there in my head. So Seattle in the 1930s turned out to be one of those places that I was interested in. So setting, and then, I guess most fundamental is there an arc to the story? Does the character or characters you're going to follow, real people in my case, do they go through experiences that rise to some kind of a climax? Do they face obstacles that they have to overcome and do overcome? And very importantly, does that experience of confronting and overcoming those obstacles, how does it change them? How do they grow as people? How are they altered by the experiences of the story? And so, I think that's the element that's often very hard to find. Is I get people telling me all the time about their grandfather or their grandmother who had a series of interesting experiences. But there needs to be more than just a litany of experiences. There needs to be a clear growth, a clear transformation of some kind in the story in order to turn it into a really first-rate narrative, I think.
I never thought about that before, but the fact that Joe's daughter is the one who brought this story to you, is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct, yeah.
Yeah, so the fact that that's the case and that you included that as part of the book must mean you get a lot of people doing that now. Does that happen?
I do. It's good. Actually, I solicit ideas. At the end of my book talk, I often say, hey, if your aunt or your grandfather or yourself had an interesting life experience, send me an email because I want as many ideas as possible. But yes, if I have packets and packets on my desk of stuff that people have sent me, and I'm slowly working my way through those. But as I say, this story had so many elements. It's a high bar to try to clear, and it's hard to match it. So I'm being pretty picky at this point.
Yeah. Do you think you would ever write a story about a character or a group of characters that failed in their goals, if the arc means that their goals changed or something else happened?
Yeah, I think I might. I mean, it's always a harder sell probably as a writer when you're pitching an idea to a publisher to sell them on the idea of a story that ends in failure. Mm-hmm. As a writer, I would find it really interesting to do that. And I do think you can write good books and good books are written about things that end disastrously.
Right.
So I think it can be done. It's just a harder sell in terms of publishers tend to like stories that have positive resolutions, and so there's that to think about. But I fundamentally answer your question. I do think, yes, you can write good books about
Polar expeditions.
Yeah, exactly.
There's no gold medal for the polar expedition.
No, not at all.
Okay, before we say goodbye, I want to just mention again that the book is The Boys in the Boat, the true story of an American team's epic journey to win gold at the 1936 Olympics. The author is Daniel James Brown. The publisher is Viking. Daniel, I want to thank you so much for speaking with me today. I very much enjoyed both of your books and talking to you about them.
Great. Thanks so much for having me. I had a lot of fun.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Daniel James Brown. You can learn more about his work at his website, danieljamesbrown.com. This week's Write the Book prompt involves considering history as you seek ideas for your work. Browse an antique store for artifacts of a period that interests you. As you look around, keep your mind open to the characters who might have once held this book or had dinner at this table or stitched this tablecloth. Choose two or three objects from a certain period in time and incorporate them into a story, poem, or essay. Try not to know ahead of time what aspect of 1923 or 1968 you plan to focus on. Instead, let the objects that you find surprise and inform you with the stories that they tell and the characters that they suggest. Good luck with this prompt, and please listen next week for another. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by Calamity and Crow's Trading Post, twisting fresh tie-dyes for individuals, businesses, and organizations with standards like eyeballs, Jerry Bears, peace signs, and their signature tie-dyed mule, custom artisan tie-dyes that rock. Contact Calamity and Crow's Trading Post on Facebook for more information. And by The Farmhouse, Burlington's farm-to-table gastropub, serving award-winning burgers, innovative entrees, and a world-class craft beer menu. So I do hope that you do occasionally tell friends about Write the Book. If you want to share information about the show with them, they should know that they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday at 2. And archived episodes of the show are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. And if you want to suggest a guest for the show, that's great. Please feel free to email writethebook@gmail.com. I should mention, though, that the show is fully booked through the end of the year, pretty much. It's crazy. But I'm always happy to hear new suggestions and think about next year. So if you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, that email address again is writethebook@gmail.com. I do have a new co-host, Gary Lee Miller. You may have heard him once or twice. He's actually going to be back in October with his next show. His website is GaryLeeMiller.com. The Radiator is here thanks to community support and involvement. Everything that you hear happening on The Radiator is thanks to the work of volunteers. So more information about The Radiator and about getting involved in The Radiator or supporting the station is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I am Shayla Shapiro, and you are listening to The Radiator, as I just said, about seven times. 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.